Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And given everything else going on in the world, this may not have gotten a lot of attention yesterday, but the new Afghan president, his name is Ashraf Ghani, was at the White House yesterday speaking with President Obama. The biggest headline out of that probably was that there will be no additional drawdown of U.S. troops from Afghanistan in this calendar year. But it was the opening comments from the Afghan president that I think has a lot of people, even though they don't know much about this guy yet, certainly starting with a pretty good impression of him, because he came very sincere, it seemed, and very thankful for the sacrifices and contributions of the American military and the American people.
I'd like to take this opportunity to pay tribute to those common sacrifices and simultaneously take the opportunity to pay tribute to the 2,215 American servicemen and women who paid the ultimate sacrifice, more than 22,000 American soldiers who've been wounded in action, civilians, numerous contractors, and others. You stood shoulder to shoulder with us, and I'd like to say thank you. I would also like to thank the American taxpayer for his and her hard-earned dollars that have enabled us.
Jim, we don't know too much about this guy. We'll see as time goes on, but he's off to an excellent start. Obviously, I think the military deserves more credit than you and I for paying our taxes, but ultimately that money was important for them too. And so for him to start that way in his visit to America, pretty impressive.
You know, I thought the most special moment there, Greg, was when Obama returned the favor by calling the Afghan leader Karzai. You know, you're right. It's all too rare that we see a foreign leader thanking Americans for their blood and treasure. And while you are correct that the sacrifice of treasure cannot compare to the ultimate sacrifice that men and women in uniform have made, let's not fool ourselves. This has been a considerable amount of money that has been spent in Afghanistan since the fall of 2001, with increasing questions of whether we have gotten our money's worth or whether this has turned into just a giant waste in a country that has, let's just say, the forces of civilization have a very steep uphill climb. His remarks were appreciated. His remarks, I think, were necessary. The news that the president will not be withdrawing all troops by 2016, as he previously announced, is a bit of a good news, although I guess I can't help but feel a certain sense of anxiety, because even if you have a top-of-the-line military, as we do, even if you have a continued presence, as we do, ultimately they all answer to the same commander-in-chief, and it just seems like he's completely upside down in his sense of who to trust and who not to trust. I mean, that's a good segue to our second martini here today.
Yeah, certainly the case. Let's move to the New York Times. Article by David Sanger and Michael Gordon, and the first three paragraphs read this way. If an agreement to limit Iran's nuclear capability is reached by deadline in the next 7 days, one thing may be missing: an actual written accord signed by the Iranians. Over the past few weeks, Iran has increasingly resisted any kind of formal framework agreement at this stage of the negotiations, preferring a more general statement of understanding, followed by a final accord in June, according to Western diplomats involved in the talks. Should that position hold, one of the many unknowns of the coming days, the United States and its five negotiating partners may find themselves in the uncomfortable position of describing the accord as they understand it, while the Iranians go home to offer their own version. So, Jim, this is just a mess all the way around.
It is. I think it's particularly striking to see the declaration that we're not writing the agreement down. That just seems like kind of the most basic assessment there. The fact that it's the New York Times pointing this out kind of indicates that these tone of these negotiations have just gotten ever more ridiculous. I mean, look, the administration wants a deal at all costs, and they don't care about what's in it almost. And despite the argument from the likes of Bibi Netanyahu that a bad deal is worse than no deal, you know, Iran doesn't want anything written down. They want a memorandum of understanding. And so, again, how do you say, oh, you know, trust, we have to trust them? It's not even written down. So we're going to say, well, they agreed to X, and they're going to turn around and say, well, actually, you agreed to Y. What's kind of fascinating is they have an unnamed European official quoted in the story saying, all of us are in agreement that you don't make oral deals with Iran. Are we? I hope we are. I certainly think we are. But this administration seems so desperate to be able to say, you know, hooray, we have a deal, that they're willing to, you know, like this seems like fairly basic, that if you don't have it written down with a clear agreement on what all the terms mean, you don't really have an agreement. And I guess that's the whole idea, is that this is an administration that is driven by perception and public relation and winning a news cycle instead of the actual facts on the ground. Because the facts on the ground that the likes of Ayatollah Khomeini are saying, death to America and things like that.
Jim, the idea that you might not write down the nuclear agreement with the world's largest sponsor of terrorism, I think we need to bring in Captain Obvious from that hotel booking site.
Yeah, you know, I guess it's kind of like if a tree falls in a forest, does anybody hear? If it's not written down, is it really an agreement? I mean, what do you have? You have a nod? You know, you have this general concept, but the moment you write it down, it loses the magic, I guess, you know, Greg.
Well, it's just carte blanche is what it is.
Yeah.
Our understanding was we could, crank up these centrifuges all we want, so...
Oh. Only test the bombs one at a time was what we thought it said. So. You didn't say that? You don't remember that talk?
It's right here in my notes.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. On to the crazy martini now. And that one was probably could have fit in crazy as well. But this is also from the New York Times. This came out over the weekend. And this is not from The Onion. This is from the New York Times. Catherine Byron, a senior at Brown University and a member of its sexual assault task force, considers it her duty to make Brown a safe place for rape victims free from anything that might prompt memories of trauma. So when she heard last fall that a student group had organized a debate about campus sexual assault between Jessica Valenti, the founder of Feministing.com, and Wendy McElroy, a libertarian, and that Ms. McElroy was likely to criticize the term rape culture, Ms. Byron was alarmed. Bringing in a speaker like that could serve to invalidate people's experiences. It could be damaging. So then they set up a simultaneous competing talk to provide research and facts about the role of culture in sexual assault and set up a safe space for anyone who found the debate too upsetting. The safe space, Ms. Byron explained, was intended to give people who might find comments troubling or triggering a place to recuperate. The room was equipped with cookies, coloring books, bubbles, Play-Doh, calming music, pillows, blankets, and a video of frolicking puppies, as well as students and staff members trained to deal with trauma. And it goes on in this story to talk about how this is happening at other schools, including Columbia. And there was even a woman from Charlie Hebdo who was criticized heavily at the University of Chicago. She's under protective detail because of what Charlie Hebdo has depicted in its cartoons. And she was accused of defending her position to the point where it wasn't safe to have dissenting opinions expressed. Jim, what hope do we have when these people are in charge?
I don't really know how you get to be in charge if hearing something you don't like, you literally have to go back to kindergarten with Play-Doh and bubbles and things like that. It was kind of like that lawyer it was a law student who argued that exams should be canceled or postponed because everyone had been so traumatized by the events in Ferguson.
Yes.
Several states away and several weeks ago. And you just kind of are left with this sense of, and he insisted that, you know, there are people who have portrayed this as oversensitivity. No, I think it's because we care too much, whatever. You're sure a law firm, you're going to hire that person? You basically have said if something upsetting happens in the news, then they can't do their job. That's not ultimately what we're about. Yes, sometimes something like 9/11 will happen, and the entire country is walking around shocked and horrified and kind of dazed for a couple of days. But ultimately, one of the things we've always kind of prided ourselves in Americans is our ability to thrive under adversity and to deal with adversity. And I guess what's interesting is that college campuses are basically the culture of the college campus is telling the college student, who, by the way, looking at the entire culture of the entire world, are among the luckiest, most blessed, most privileged, shall we say, people in the entire world, right? I mean, yes, you're studying hard and all that kind of stuff, but ultimately you're generally in a safe environment. You're learning, you have a bright future ahead of you, and yet somehow you walk around with this constant sense of victimhood to the point where you say that if you encounter someone who disagrees with you, you can't function. Well, ultimately, that's not what life is about. Life is not about retreating to the Play-Doh and bubbles when things get hard, because otherwise you're never going to get out of the room with the Play-Doh and bubbles, and at some point that room's going to close. And somebody's got to pay for the Play-Doh. Somebody's got to pay for the bubbles. You need to find a way to make a living. And these folks don't want to have that. They don't want to function with that. I also find it really fascinating they're talking about safe space when somebody from Charlie Hebdo, like a safe space from hearing views they don't agree with, versus the woman from Charlie Hebdo needs a safe space from people trying to kill her. Absolutely no sense of what genuine problems are. And then finally, the last point, I assume you saw, maybe seen the middle of the day yesterday, Greg, a discussion of some feminist conference, and it was declared that the sound of applause can be upsetting and triggering to people in the audience, so everyone was urged to use jazz hands. Thankfully, this is a podcast. There's no visual element, and I have no need to demonstrate what jazz hands are. Now, I have a funny response and a serious response. I'll start with the serious response. If the sound of applause puts you in some sort of really deep, upset state where you can't function, you need professional help. You need a therapist so that you can function in the world, because you never know when you're going to hear applause or some other loud noise. And if, you know, people who have post-traumatic, we have people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who don't flip out when they hear a car backfiring, right? I mean, they eventually figure out a way to cope with it, a way to function, because otherwise you are curled up in a ball and you are not living your life. Instead, these people, like, on the one hand, they're traumatized by the sound of applause, but they're courageous enough to tell everyone else, you can't do this utterly normal behavior because it upsets me. It's this very strange, very selective vulnerability, because the idea of, I'm going to applaud, I don't care what you say, they're willing to brave that. So that was my serious response. And if you really, if this is a genuine concern that somehow you go into a catatonic state or some sort of deeply upset panic attack over the sound of applause, then yes, please seek professional therapy and help. The more less serious response, Greg, is when somebody has the courage to come forward and say, I need everyone around me to not clap because I find that sound upsetting. You and I might see it silly, but you know what another term for it is, Greg?
What's that?
Brave, right? I mean, this takes courage to stand for it. So I hear something like that, somebody willing to just admit that vulnerability to everyone, and I just think they deserve a big round of applause. Give it to them. Oh, no, wait, no, stop. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, dear. Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, you have to be safe from opinions. That kind of defeats the whole purpose of college.
Yeah, that's the other thing, which is like, heaven forbid you hear something you haven't heard before, right? Which, isn't that really what education is, right? If you've already heard it, then it's not really education.
Oh, yeah, I'm guessing some opinions are safer than others, too. So, Jim, I can't think of anything crazier. Let's go there, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.